Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors, exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness with Dr. Jack Gansler and Bill Lucian from the University of Maryland's School of Public Policy and authors of the IBM Center report, 8 Actions to Improve Defense Acquisition. So in your report, Jack and Bill, you reference or outline 8 actions that can be taken to improve the results of acquisition programs and at the same time strengthen industrial base, the DoD industrial base, or the defense industrial base to be specific. I want to explore each one of these recommended actions. And the first one, you counsel folks to use the appropriate form of competition during all phases of acquisition. What is the problem that you're the remedy, the action that you're kind of diagnosing? What's the issue there? What are folks not using the right types of contracts?
How do you create continuous incentives?
Okay.
It's the incentives part that people
they're missing.
Are missing. Okay. And you want to do it for the right reasons. So if you're one of the suppliers, you want to figure out, how do I get a higher profit with a guaranteed follow-on? And the way you do it is getting higher and higher performance at lower and lower costs with higher and higher reliability. And so we want to figure out how to compete in each phase of the program. You start with the prototypes, and that's where the technology is first demonstrated. Then you want to make sure you compete that, at least have 2, maybe 3. It depends upon, you know, how expensive it is and who has the best ideas. But that's where new technology comes in right away. And then when you get into the production phase, there's always continuous change taking place. Thousands of changes for one reason or another on most of these big programs. And they want those to be offered in a competitive environment. So I want to change something. I decided I like to have something else added. I mean, people who build houses understand this. Oh, yeah. Oh, you forgot to add windows, you know. And, oh, we want windows in the back, you know. And so, the cost of doing that on a sole source basis is going to be very high. In a competitive environment, what you find is, we can do it for the same price as we had originally given you. And that's what happens in the real world in competition. That's what market forces do. And we have to make sure that occurs not only in the prototype and the production, but also in the support, because that's the big cost, as Bill mentioned earlier, the operating and maintenance costs. And so we need to figure out ways to keep that competition going.
Yeah, the other challenge is that people often want to have competition for competition's sake. Mm-hmm. And so when you have services, you want to make sure that the company that's providing the service will make investments to improve their provision of that service. And so then they have to have some time to make that money back. And so you want the contract to be long enough so they can make the appropriate investments. And if they continually improve on the provision of that service, you'd like to reward them with a follow-on contract and not necessarily compete it. If you mandate competition every 2 or 3 years, the inclination is going to be not to invest any money, but to provide the service at the lowest cost possible and increase your profits, knowing that there's an excellent chance that you may lose that contract in the next go around.
Yeah, so I want to actually understand, you kind of touched on the different types of competition, Jack, when you mentioned it. And Bill, you just mentioned the idea of competition for its own sake is not necessarily fruitful. So what are the key steps in implementing the recommended action you folks are outline in your report?
Well, one thing that is hard to do perhaps, but necessary, and that is past performance should matter and whether you're a qualified source. Because if you have a good historic record, that will help a lot in simplifying the process. And the other thing you want to do is to not drive the cost very high for the competition. Mm-hmm. So if you have 1,000 people bidding on it, you know, that may be fair, but it's also much more expensive. And in fact, people don't try very hard when they have that 1,000 people bidding against them, because the probability of win is small. And so you want to shape the competition. And that's why the prototype competition is usually just 2 or 3 that are funded. In all cases, they will have gone through a qualification first. Are they qualified? Do they know what they're doing? Have they a decent history? And then let them demonstrate. And the demonstration is a key piece of this competition in that case.
Bill?
Well, I think you want to monitor the competition at the sub-tier levels also, because often at the system level, several competitors may be using the same provider for some subsystem, and if you don't have competition at that level, for example, the engine, you wind up with one source effectively for a high cost item. So you want to watch that competition at the sub tier level also.
In fact, it's important that people don't recognize a typical airplane, for example, 85% of the costs are in the subsystems. The electronics, the radar, the engines, all of the things that go into it. Just final assembly and test is maybe 20% of the cost. And you don't need two lines to do that because it's not going to really be that cost effective. But as Bill points out, if you had competition on the engines, competition on the radars, competition on the avionics systems, et cetera, that's where the big cost savings can come about because that's 85% of the costs.
And I know this is off book, if you will, but when you do stuff like that, when you compete the subsystems, do you think that there's a need for a lead systems integrator in this kind of an environment, or is this something you want to touch on at all?
Yes, because you want someone who knows what they're doing. Again, and one of the things that's been proposed recently by the Air Force is that the government be the lead systems integrator for ICBMs. And, you know, why wouldn't you use the two or three companies that have done it before? And again, you need a lead systems integrator, but you also need to encourage them. And you want to have some visibility on the government side into the fact that they are or are not competing the lower tiers. Okay. Particularly the critical elements of the lower tiers. Now, when you can use commodities, you know, it's commercial stuff, then the market's taking care of that in a certain sense because the market is competitive. But you need to know something about the quality of the stuff that they're giving you, and you keep testing it. And if it it has to be reliable as well as lower cost and high performance.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other action you gentlemen outline in your report is the focus on the proper use of, it's Alphabet City, but it's indefinite delivery and indefinite quantity, IDIQ contracts, which I think has become its own word now. What are IDIQs? And perhaps you could highlight some of the examples in action. And would you outline the benefits to both government and contractors for using this type of contract?
Well, the concept behind it is indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity. You don't know how many you're going to buy and when you're going to need them. But on the other hand, the concept behind it is also that you're going to have a couple of qualified people that can bid competitively. Now, somehow to be fair, and there's always this question of fairness versus effective and efficient, but to be fair, they say, well, let's have anybody who wants to be an accepted winner to bid on these. And one of them I can think of is the Navy program has 2,200 winners. So if every time they put out a request, and the government is now even forcing people to say when you have an IDIQ that all of the people who are the winners on the first round, the qualification round, must therefore bid on each of the items that come out for bid. And that's very expensive in the bid and proposal cost.
Yeah, why would I want to do that overhead-wise from
the contractor? See, that's the point. The reason you want to do it is to avoid protest.
Oh.
And this is a major issue that if you know, Joe's Garage says, I want to bid on this, and, well, Joe, I'm sorry, you're not qualified, then Joe will protest. It's not fair. And so they avoid the protest round, which often delays programs significantly. And many companies today are even using protests as a strategy.
It's fascinating how many more you see nowadays.
Well, if you're the incumbent, then by protesting, you delay the shift to somebody else for 6 months or 9 months or longer, you know, during the legal process.
Bill, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, well, I think one of the key benefits of the government is the reduced administrative burden. So you get all these contractors to agree to terms and conditions, and then you can put out a task order and quickly get the work accomplished or the product purchased. So that's a key benefit to the government. So it's a noble goal, but often if they're misused, they wind up with a lot of unintended consequences.
And could you expand on that? What are some of the abuses of the IDIQs? I think Jack alluded to a couple, but
well, you can have you can bundle a lot of tasks into these big omnibus contracts, and then try to get those awarded. You can award too many, have too many awardees for the amount of work that needs to be done. So a lot of people wind up with very little or no work under these contracts. You can sometimes discourage people from submitting unsolicited proposals because you feel if they solicit it, then the sponsor feels like they have to compete it out and they'll put it out for a reward under one of these contracts. And so there's a lot of things that happen with these contracts that wind up causing issues for both the providers and for the government.
So what are some of the steps that you folks offer in your report for implementing the proper use of IDIQs? What some recommendations do you have?
Well, more limited use of it, for one thing, as Bill pointed out, that when you have thousands of people bidding, it just doesn't make sense. And so you do it by scope and prior performance of those companies that have experience and know what they're doing. And you don't drive it up to 1,000 people putting in their proposals. You know, and so your chances of winning, again, using all these things are done for incentive reasons. And if you are bidding against two or three companies, your chances are much better, especially if you've got a good record and you can make an attractive bid. So you're more tended to bid on them rather than abusing it. That's the way I think I would do it, Bill.
Well, I think a key is to scale the contract to the work that you expect. And so if you only expect X amount of dollars to be awarded, you would scale it so you don't have so many awards that most people won't get any awards or won't get any work or get very little work under the contract. And I think that's a complaint we hear from many companies and contractors, that they put all this work together, put these proposals together, submit them, get awarded, and then they don't get any awards under the contract.
We'll identify more actions to improve defense acquisition when this special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns.